She wants to get reelected. She's afraid to confront the military that basically handles national security issues.
Former Governor Bill Richardson talks with VOA about Myanmar. It's Monday, January 29th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, the U.S. Defense Secretary wraps up his visit to Southeast Asia, visiting a Mumbai slum. Juilliard contemplates Chinese music, vaping vitamins, and more realistic virtual reality. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson resigned last week from an international board that advises Myanmar on the Rohingya crisis, charging the panel was not committed to change in the Southeast Asian country. Richardson, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and energy secretary in the Bill Clinton administration, quit in the midst of the board's first visit to Western Rakhine State, where nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled a military crackdown on insurgents. Richardson said Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi was deficient in moral leadership, an accusation that came 2 days after a meeting with her and other board members. VOA Cindy Sain spoke via Skype with the former New Mexico governor about his opinion of the board and what is happening in Myanmar right now.
I resigned. They're claiming that I was fired, but they were begging me to stay till the very last minute by the National Security Advisor. I resigned for two reasons. One, because I felt the advisory board was just a whitewashing operation meant to validate the policies of the government of Myanmar. The second reason is an explosive reaction Aung San Suu Kyi had as I was trying to give her frank advice to deal fairly with the two Reuters journalists that had been in prison. That showed me that she wasn't interested in frank advice. And this is after 30 years of a very strong friendship where we've worked together for democracy. That has obviously been shattered by my resignation.
Right, right. And I, you know, it's well documented that you've been a very good friend of Myanmar's civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, for many, many years. And she asked you to join the council. Was she herself, I know that the two Reuters journalists were an issue, was she herself also disparaging the United Nations journalists and relief workers trying to get the facts and alleviate suffering in the area?
Yes, certainly her chairman was, but she also, in various conversations, has disparaged the UN, felt the UN was unfair to her, the human rights investigation especially, disparaging the international media, disparaging human rights group, saying that they're all against her. These are the people that worked with her in that transition to democracy, that were her supporters, were in essence given her the Nobel Prize. She's now feels an us against one situation, an us against them situation, and has a siege mentality right now. She's changed.
Right. I was going to ask if you were sort of blindsided and really surprised by this. And do you think that she's changed now that she's in a position of power, or does she have a blind spot when it comes to the Rohingyas?
No, I think she's changed as she's assumed power. She wants to get reelected. She's afraid to confront the military that basically handles national security issues, like treatment of refugees, like I think they've been responsible for the atrocities. They have participated in the mass graves issue, finding ways, instead of helping the refugees move back to Myanmar, making it more difficult, not guaranteeing safety. And I think she's been afraid to confront them. There is a separation of power between the military and the civilian government that she heads, but she's failed to exercise moral leadership to push and tell the military that they can't keep doing this. She doesn't have control over them, but the fact that she not only doesn't speak out, but defends them is what has made her change, and I think has caused a lot of these problems that Myanmar has with the international community.
Right. What would you say to critics who say that Aung San Suu Kyi has to walk a fine line in her power-sharing position with Myanmar's military rulers?
Well, I'm a politician. I know you have to balance between the existing power centers. You can't just attack everybody. But I think she's overdone her consent in what the military has done. And stop defending them. Exercise more leadership by saying, look, military, we can't continue torturing the Rohingya. Let's find a way to deal with these very serious problems. Okay. That instead of constantly blaming the West and the international community and the UN and the United States and Canada and the European Union, instead of owning up to the problem, she shifts blames to everybody else and fails to deal with the issue by not confronting the military, letting them basically run amok.
Right. We just got word that the advisory board is now backing the government's plan to repatriate returning Rohingya refugees. What is your feeling about that?
Well, I think that's part of the whitewash. Look, the government of Bangladesh, the United Nations Human Rights Group, say that this repatriation is not ready. And this is why the government of Bangladesh has delayed the repatriation, because these refugees aren't assured of their safety. They're probably thinking they're going to end up in mass graves. They have no guarantees about their citizenship. They should be given a path to citizenship. There's no guarantee that they're going to be able to go back to their homes safely.
Yes.
Their homes may have been destroyed and burned down. So I think this is another instance where this is a whitewash. And just to conclude on this issue, the advisory board met with Aung San Suu Kyi secretly without me. They didn't want me there because they didn't want to hear my candid advice. That's the straw that broke the camel's back. They don't want my advice. I leave. That's why I left.
Right, right. Do you think the Trump administration is doing enough to help the Rohingyas?
Yeah, I stand. I got to say, the Trump administration has spoken out for internal investigations to treat the Rohingyas properly. They came out early to release the journalists. I was briefed by the American ambassador about a month ago. Secretary Tillerson called me, told me what they were doing. Yeah, I think the Trump administration, the State Department, is doing well on this issue. I think as long as they keep it away from the president, they're doing okay.
U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson speaking exclusively via Skype with VOA's Cindy Say. These are among some of the top Asia stories that are trending on voanews.com. Afghanistan observes National Day of Mourning as death toll rises. 7 survivors of missing ferry found adrift in the Pacific. United States accepts more refugees from Australian offshore camps. Polish team rescues French climber on Pakistan's Killer Mountain. Tokyo's coin check to return $425 million in virtual money lost to hackers. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has praised the talks between North and South Korea, but says they do not address the overarching issue in the standoff over Pyongyang's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. We hear more from VOA's Bill Gallo, who's traveling with the secretary now in Hawaii.
A unified front against North Korea, as the defense chiefs of South Korea and the U.S. met at Pacific Command headquarters.
Our combined militaries stand shoulder to shoulder, ready to defend against any attack on the ROK or USA.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, once again, speaking of military options against North Korea.
Our response to this threat remains diplomacy-led, backed up with military options available to ensure that our diplomats are understood to be speaking from a position of strength.
The talks come as North and South Korea engage in negotiations about next month's Winter Olympics in South Korea. North Korea has agreed to send a delegation to the Games. Mattis praised the talks, but expressed caution about what they can achieve.
The Olympics talks alone do not address overarching problems.
South Korea's defense minister stressed his country is ultimately trying to draw out North Korea to a dialogue with the U.S. North Korea in September conducted its sixth and largest nuclear test. Its ballistic missile program is also advancing. South Korea's foreign minister this week said military options are unacceptable and that the situation should be solved by diplomacy.
The problem is war by inadvertence or by accident. When you have a highly pressurized situation, anything can happen. And people will attribute the worst possible motives to the other party behind what's been done. I think there's still room for diplomacy.
Mattis was asked during the trip whether he thinks the threat of a U.S. attack will eventually persuade North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to back down. He said he has, quote, modest expectations of his ability to predict Kim's behavior. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
Happening now in Asia, Afghanistan held a national day of mourning Sunday, the day after insurgents used an explosive-laden ambulance to carry out a deadly attack outside a government building in Kabul. Officials said the death toll has risen to 103 people, 235 wounded. The Taliban has claimed responsibility. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're starting out your week with us on VOA Asia. If you're planning a visit to India, why not make sure Mumbai's largest slum is on your places to visit? The slum packs some 1 million people into about 2 square kilometers, and it has emerged as an unlikely stop for foreign tourists. The draw is not images of squalor and poverty in the heart of India's largest city. It is, as Anjana Pasricha tells us, a place where thriving entrepreneurship and stories of hope and success break many stereotypes of a slum.
In his cramped workshop in Mumbai's Dharavi slum district, Mohammed Sheikh sifts through thousands of plastic cups that will be turned into pellets for reuse. Since coming from a village 10 years ago, the small recycling business he has built in the slum's dingy alleys enables him to give a decent education to his children.
It's all good here. I have no problems. I manage my expenses very well.
Thousands of ramshackle workshops have mushroomed haphazardly in Dharavi as residents and an endless stream of migrants turned their hand to whatever they could, recycling the city's waste, making leather goods or garments. Today, these micro-businesses produce goods worth $1 billion and have scripted many success stories. Like that of Sohail Akhtar, who employs 6 workers in his tiny garment unit. 25 years ago, he was a worker himself. Residents like him are resisting efforts to redevelop the slum, a prime slice of land in the city's heart, where the government has offered to rehouse residents in modern buildings.
If facilities improve, our costs will increase. We work on very tiny budgets, and it will become difficult for us to survive.
Inside these narrow alleys, tourists get a perspective on why residents don't want to move out of Dharavi. No one explains it better than tour guide Ankit Gajakosh, who has co-founded Mumblu Tours. Having grown up in the area, he knows firsthand how this slum can be a driving force to improve one's life.
People are not begging, people are not into crime, people are not addicted to drugs over here. Why? Because there is so much of jobs to do. People, if they want to work, they can work and earn money. And that's how the entire environment in this place is different, quite different.
That is what tourists like Beata Pick and Panlop Thantiam discover beneath Dharavi's ramshackle veneer, energy and entrepreneurship.
It's really, really tough, but also really surprising, and it's a real eye-opener, I would say. For a person like me, it was great to know that you can actually have a happy life in a really different condition.
I saw it, it's like us, but it's a different in the country and occupation. I do my job to get money. They do their job to get money and live their life. That's all. It's quite similar.
Dharavi may be counted among Asia's largest slums, but it is also a symbol of hope and opportunity for the underprivileged. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
You're listening to VOA Asia. The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This news alert from VOA Asia. A French woman who has been found alive on the treacherous northern Himalayan peak known as Killer Mountain, but her Polish climbing companion remains missing. An elite Polish climbing team attempting the first winter ascent of nearby K2 Mountain dropped their efforts to rescue the two stranded climbers. You'll reach the summit of great stories and features by visiting VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Without the use of traditional instruments in an interconnected world, what makes a Chinese composition distinctly Chinese? The Juilliard School's Focus Festival 2018 is seeking to challenge our preconceptions. It's led by a cast of contemporary Chinese composers and acclaimed Juilliard orchestral students. VOA's Ramon Taylor sat down with one of China's most prominent young conductors and the festival's founding director on the evolving commonalities and differences of orchestral music East and West.
What do the two largest economies in the world share in common? For one, a fervent passion for orchestra music. At the Juilliard School's 2018 Focus Festival in New York, China today, there are few traditional Chinese instruments on stage, but that doesn't make the performances assembled by Chinese composers any less Chinese.
Most of this event was featured through Western orchestra. However, you can find many Chinese musical elements in most of the melodies, harmonies, and other musical imagery throughout the whole performance.
Joel Sachs, director of the festival and professor of music history, notes that one popular phenomenon among the festival's composers, and in Chinese music more broadly, is the use of nature images as a starting point for their compositions. But the difficulty in identifying the origin of a piece, he says, is not limited to our modern era cultural and economic globalization.
I think if one knew a lot about the music of the late 18th century and you listened to certain works by Mozart and not know who it was, you think it's an Italian composer. And I'm not just talking about opera, but his whole style. And yet, on other occasions, if you look at Mozart, you're sure he speaks German. Now, these days, it's really hard to tell, and sometimes it's because of our ignorance.
Chen Ling, one of China's most prominent young conductors and professor at the world-acclaimed Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing, conducted three works by influential contemporary Chinese composers Chen Qiyong, Guo Wenqing, and the late Qiu Qianer. The opening number can be roughly translated as chaotic picking, one that requires an infectious energy on stage.
The performance by Luan Tan by Chen Qigong requires the performers as well as the conductor to accumulate a lot of energy towards the later part of presentation and reach an explosive crescendo towards the end.
Now in its 34th year, the Focus Festival for Sachs continues to be a process of discovery.
It's the pleasure of seeing people suddenly realize that there's more music than they ever imagined existed in the world, and that it's kind of endless, and that if you're willing to explore, you never get bored.
Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Swiss tennis star Roger Federer has defeated Marin Cilic of Croatia 6-2, 6-7, 6-3, 3-6, 6-1. To win the 2018 Australian Open in Melbourne. It's Federer's 20th Grand Slam title, and after going 4 years without winning a major, he's now won three of the last five. You'll be a big winner as well by visiting VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a Los Angeles-based company claims it is turning people's bad habits into good ones with a range of vape-able vitamin supplements. But medical experts say there are no studies yet that show that inhaling nutrients is any better than taking vitamin pills or simply eating right. We take in the story with VOA's Faith Lapidus.
Vitamins and nutritional supplements are a $13.4 billion a year business. Most of those pills are chewed or swallowed. Now, they can be vaped. These slim metal dispensers from Inhale Health, a Beverly Hills biotech company, release vaporized vitamins, caffeine, or melatonin.
Inhale Health is about shifting the world to a new era of functional inhalation. We can build inhalable products around micronutrients and beneficial compounds.
The company claims pharmaceutical-grade B vitamins in liquid form can be turned into a vapor that retains nutritional value and can be quickly absorbed by the body.
We contracted a third-party lab, SN Labs, out of Santa Ana, California, and we had them conduct a test to prove that the liquid vitamins transitioned successfully into the aerosolized state. So what that means is that the compounds, the value-added molecules, vitamins, micronutrients, etc., were present in the liquid, and they also were present in the vapor state.
Pharmacist David Yasher sells the dispensers at his store and says the sleep inhaler, which contains the hormone melatonin, is the best seller.
We have a lot of patients that come in for, you know, jet lag. They complain that melatonin causes a lot of headaches and grogginess the next day. One thing that we realize with this product, with the melatonin product in particular, is that it doesn't cause those side effects. And it works much quicker. So within 10 to 15 minutes, the product starts to work and you get a good night's rest. You wake up fresh.
But is vaping your vitamins the way to go?
It's very unnatural, actually, to be done via the lungs. Vitamins are meant to really be ingested, and I don't see a reason why one would want to vape that. Whether or not there's any benefit, I haven't seen any controlled studies to say whether there's a benefit or whether there's a risk. But medicine is a good part science, but also a good part of common sense.
Of course, the common sense way to ingest your daily requirement of vitamins and minerals is to eat nutritious food. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
There's little doubt that virtual reality is likely to be the future of video gaming. Now a Russian company in Moscow is pushing the limits of the technology with a game-changing VR experience. VOA's Kevin Enix brings us the real details.
It's not much to look at from this angle, just a bunch of people wandering around a warehouse. But from this angle, it's a battle to the death against zombies in a post-apocalyptic Moscow. Judging from the players' reactions, it's a hit.
The feelings are great and unusual. Before playing, I was scared because you don't know what to expect, and when you play, it is a bit scary too.
It's quite real. Most of the time I was standing on the edge and I was looking over, as the visuals you see are very, very cool.
Here's how it works. Players wear markers on their legs, arms, heads, and weapons that are tracked by infrared cameras. That information is sent in real time back to the players' VR headsets.
The full body technology allows players to dive into virtual reality as much as possible. Your own leg and arm movements in physical reality match the moves in virtual reality. You can come close to your friend to shake their hand, to give them a high five. All of these things allow you to immerse yourself into the world you've come to play in.
The creators say the feeling can be unsettling and feel very, very real.
You experience very unusual feelings when you're inside the game, when you don't observe it from outside. But when you become a game character, people are scared of heights. Players can experience vertigo because they begin to think they are on the 60th floor when they look down.
The real-time VR technology has clear applications beyond gaming.
The technology can be used for military simulations, training programs for the police, for the military, for the emergency services, etc.
Or it can be used to clear out a horde of zombies.
The feeling is of absolute reality. I understood that this is a staged set, but my brain didn't realize that. I had a feeling this is how it should be.
The Russian company behind the game is already planning game spaces in London and Miami, opening this year. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud and download us as a podcast. Take VOA Asia wherever you happen to go during your day. One of the best ways to listen to VOA Asia, of course, is on the radio. If you happen to be in Tainan, Taiwan, catch us on the voice of Chungrung Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University. That's in Tainan, Taiwan. We thank you for listening wherever you happen to be, and we thank our director Tracy Carter and engineer John Ellison for helping bring this program to you, along with managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.